Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 6, the 24th of April. At 10:30 on the 24th of April, the 8th Guards Army from the 1st Belarusian Front met the 3rd Guards Tank Army of the 1st Ukrainian Front at Bornsdorf in Treptow. 2 hours later, infantry from both fronts would meet nearby at the Schönefelder Junction near Brusendorf. This link-up between the mechanized and infantry units from both Soviet fronts signaled the formal encirclement of the German 9th Army. The pocket the 9th Army now found themselves in would be known to history as the Halber Pocket, or, in German, the Kessel von Halber, literally Cauldron of Halber. But whilst the town of Halber did represent the central breakout point of the 9th Army westwards, the pocket itself contained dozens of small towns and villages, which would all see brutal fighting from now on until the end of the war. Not only that, but the geography of the pocket itself would become an actor in its own right, as it presented an increasingly difficult terrain to navigate for both attacker and defender. The area of the Halber Pocket at its largest extent measured 25 kilometers across and 80 kilometers from north to south, approximately 2,000 square kilometers in total. This area was bordered to the south by the great forests of the Spreewald and to the north by the ancient stream valleys of Berlin. To the east and northeast, there were large lakes such as Schwielochsee and Scharmützelsee, which is the largest lake in Brandenburg, whilst to the west lay the lowlands and wetlands of the Neuter and Nieplitz rivers. These geographical features weren't just limited to the extremities of the pocket, however, because the fighting area within the pocket was further crisscrossed by rivers, streams, forests, marshlands, and moorland. The geography of the area would be exploited by the defenders wherever possible, with the numerous rivers and lakes in particular offering natural barriers which slowed down Soviet tanks and infantry. Plus, the ample forest coverage allowed for some concealment from Soviet air attacks. This would prove vital when the Soviets brought their air supremacy down to bear on the retreating columns of troops and civilians. However, the geography of the area also severely limited the movement of the German 9th Army, with the sandy and marshy ground proving a nightmare for German tanks and heavy transport vehicles to navigate. Moreover, whilst people can move through narrow forest paths, the same cannot be said for an almost 70-ton King Tiger tank. This is why it became vital for the Germans to hold important transport hubs, such as the town of Märkisch-Buchholz, with its key bridge over the Dahme River. Whilst the geography of the area provided opportunities and drawbacks to the Germans and Soviets alike, one thing could always be counted upon to assist the Soviets in applying pressure to the pocket: the efficient German road system. Given that Halber and the surrounding area are located so close to Berlin, it's no surprise that the area boasted a good road network in 1945, with the roads leading from east to west being particularly key to the 9th Army retreat westwards. However, the Soviets also used the road system to their advantage. For instance, the area's autobahns and major roads had been used by the Soviet tank armies to rapidly penetrate into the Brandenburg hinterland and cut off the 9th Army in the first place. The Soviets then turned these autobahns and major roads into key defensive choke points, and their tank armies roamed up and down these roads freely with literally thousands of tanks. This formed a formidable mobile defensive screen which the 9th Army would have to punch through if they wanted to escape west. Whilst the Reichsbahn had collapsed at this late stage of the war, and therefore plays no part in our story, the 9th Army were able to establish a small landing strip outside of the village of Kierig in the eastern half of the pocket. This enabled them to enjoy some limited amounts of resupply from the Luftwaffe, at least initially. In any case, what the 9th Army really needed was an escape path which offered the shortest possible route west, but which also contained a sufficiently built-up road system upon which its remaining heavy tanks could operate. Thus, the town of Halber became the epicenter of that escape route. Halber was positioned closest to Wenck's 12th Army in the west, and it also contained that all-important road network needed to facilitate a successful armoured breakout. Crucially, following Halber, an escape route could then be carved out towards the relatively lake-free area of Krummersdorfgut and beyond. By the 24th of April, the 9th Army represented a hodgepodge of 80,000 men coming from a variety of different armies. The bulk of the troops still came from Busse's 11th SS Panzer Corps and the 5th SS Mountain Corps, but by now these numbers had been boosted by the arrival of 5th Corps from the 4th Panzer Army, plus the Frankfurt Oder garrison was also on its way to join them. Whilst the German sources give a figure of 80,000 men, the Soviets were keen to exaggerate this number upwards in order to increase the propaganda effect of the encirclement. Thus, the Soviets in later years liked to claim that over 200,000 men were trapped in the pocket, along with 300 tanks and 2,000 guns. A later US Army report, however, placed the number of fighting men closer to 40,000. In my view, the figure of 80,000 fighting men seems to be the most accurate of all the estimates. But this doesn't account for everyone who was trapped in the pocket, because within the pocket there were Wehrmacht employees, female flak and signals auxiliaries, German civilians, German refugees, foreign forced labourers, prisoners of war, and even concentration camp inmates. Given the chaos which reigned inside the pocket, and the huge numbers of displaced people during the final weeks of the war, it's pretty much impossible to give an exact number of the people trapped there. That said, estimates range from a total of 150,000 to 200,000 people. But whatever the true number, what is certainly clear is that the fighting prowess of Busse's remaining forces was severely limited. Yes, some impressive units remained, such as the 11th SS Panzer Corps, but a lot of the fighting men found in the pocket would consist of Luftwaffe ground personnel and Volkssturm units who had been dragooned into the front line. Moreover, Busse's army had been given an absolute pasting at the Zeelo Heights, so the 9th Army also counted thousands of injured servicemen amongst its numbers as well. After a week of fighting and retreating, Busse's forces had been eroded down to at least half of their original strength in terms of manpower and firepower, and there were estimates of less than 1,000 artillery pieces and mortars for the 9th Army remaining. And for these remaining guns, there was a quickly diminishing amount of ammunition. On the 24th of April, the 9th Army sent a report to the Army Group Vistula headquarters, saying that 5th Corps only had 79 tanks of all kinds remaining, and that 11th SS Panzer Corps only had 36 tanks left. This report didn't give any exact numbers for its other units, but we can assume the numbers of tanks were low. Probably, we're looking at a total of only 250 armoured vehicles for the entire 9th Army when the pocket was formed, of which only 150 to 200 were battle ready. In any case, the worsening fuel and ammunition situation created an ever-shortening shelf life for these vehicles. And on the Soviet side? After acknowledging Moscow's directive to encircle and contain the 9th Army, Zhukov and Konev had now brought their forces into position. And in true Soviet style, they were able to bring an impressive array of men and firepower to bear down upon Busse's beleaguered army. Zhukov's 1st Belarusian Front to the north and east of the pocket consisted of the 3rd, 69th and 33rd Armies, along with the 2nd Guards Cavalry Corps. From the west and south, Konev had positioned the 28th Army and 3rd Guards Army. In addition, artillery units and air support from the 2nd and 16th Air Armies were ordered to grind down the German 9th Army with constant aerial and long-range bombardments. These Soviet forces totaled somewhere in the region of 280,000 men, 7,400 artillery and mortar pieces, 280 tanks and self-propelled guns, and more than 1,500 aircraft. But remember, in comparison to the Germans, the Soviets have got one more card up their sleeve. They are able to replace their men, vehicles, and guns with ease. Plus, they enjoy an embarrassment of riches when it comes to ammunition right now. So yes, the scales were certainly tipped in favour of the Soviets, I would say. The 24th of April didn't just signal the formal encirclement of the 9th Army. It also saw a worsening of the conditions within the pocket. On the 24th, the Soviet air forces ramped up their attacks, with the 16th Air Army flying over 2,000 sorties alone that day. These aerial attacks specifically targeted tanks, armoured vehicles and ammunition transports with the intention of degrading the ability of the 9th Army to fight back. The 9th Army also faced increasing pressure from Zhukov's land forces, with his armies penetrating deep across the Teltow Canal to the west of Fürstenwalde. Rauen and Gilmitz were lost on this day, and the northern approaches to the town of Kilpin were also under attack. Whilst to the west of the pocket, Konya's forces continued building their defensive positions to prevent a breakout from the 9th Army. Inside the pocket, the 9th Army possessed nothing in the way of aerial reconnaissance, so they were unable to get either a full understanding of their own situation or understand the forces arranged against them. Communication between the various units was breaking down, and leadership within those units was starting to deteriorate. The fighting on the 24th therefore signalled a start of what was to come. Isolated battles in the forests between battle-hardened Soviet troops and ragtag elements of German infantry. The Germans would attempt to blunt the Soviet advance with counterattacks any time a position was lost. But these counterattacks were uncoordinated and badly led, and they also lacked the requisite number of men and firepower needed to dislodge the Soviets. But even though the situation for the 9th Army was worsening, hope had been stirred by the plan to link up with Wenck's 12th Army to the west. And today, Wenck will launch his rescue mission. In the evening of the 24th, Wenck's 12th Army Theodor Kerner Division attacked the Soviet 5th Guards Mechanized Corps near Treuenbrietzen. When hearing of this attack, Konev was concerned, because he had originally believed the 12th Army to be a weak force, unable at mounting any offensive operations. But now, they were taking the fight to his forces? Konev was also unsure how to interpret the 12th Army's attack. The most logical approach was to view the 12th Army's movement eastwards as the first step towards a rumoured multi-front counterattack aimed at relieving Berlin. After all, Konev was fixated on Berlin, so wouldn't the Germans be equally fixated on Berlin? Plus, the Nazis had been broadcasting over the radio in Berlin that Wenck was on his way to save them. So what was the 12th Army doing attacking Treuenbrietzen, Konev thought? They weren't planning to link up with the 9th Army, were they? Konev would soon find out.